It's so nice to have you back, Jeff, on this podcast.
It's great to be back. Great to see you again.
And let's get started with what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. How do you find it right now? Zelensky is in New York. He wants to talk with Joe Biden. But we've learned just yesterday, he did an interview with one of the major news media in the United States, in which he was talking about the continuation of the conflict. And on the other hand, Russians are talking about that they're not willing to negotiate with Zelensky and anybody in his administration because they don't recognize this administration as legitimate. How do you find it right now, the current phase of the conflict? Are we getting to the point that everybody is understanding that we have to have a negotiating table? Or, as the foreign minister of the United Kingdom mentioned, this war goes to 2026 and beyond?
I think everything that's going on with Zelensky at the moment is a sign of desperation. Ukraine is losing the war very badly. The end is coming in sight, and it's not a very pleasant end as far as Ukraine is concerned. Western support for Ukraine is faltering. It's a series of desperate acts that Zelensky is engaged in at the moment. And his goal is, and in a way, this has been his goal all throughout the conflict, is to find some way of directly involving NATO in the war, direct intervention by NATO, because that's the only way that Ukraine is going to survive the war, is going to be able to win the war in any meaningful sense. So that's what Zelensky's game is, and he's trying kind of various kind of like tactics and approaches to secure that goal. So ahead of going to the States, there was a lot of publicity about he had this victory plan which he was going to present to Biden in the United States. But then just recently, he started talking about, well, you know, the war in Ukraine is going to come to an end quite soon, or it could come to an end quite soon, you know, given certain conditions. So one moment he's talking about a plan for victory, now he's talking kind of, indirectly anyway, about a plan for peace. All of that is just kind of propaganda. A barrage to confuse the situation. His goal is to find the ways of escalating Western support for Ukraine. And at the moment, what he's trying to achieve initially is to try and get this authorization for long-range missile strikes on Russia using British, American, and French weapons. Now, all the signs are that he's not going to achieve that goal, at least all the public signs are, because all the messages are that, at least as far as the Americans concerned, that they don't have enough missiles to supply Ukraine to make any huge difference to what's going on in the war. They don't think these long-range missile strikes are going to have a great deal of effect anyway. They're certainly not going to change the tactical and strategic realities on the battlefield in the Donbass and elsewhere. And thirdly, they are, at least some elements of the administration, are genuinely worried about the danger of escalation. Of course, you know, we had this very, very clear warning from Putin recently that he would view this, you know, long-range missile attacks by Western missiles on Russia would be a significant escalation, he would respond in kind. And the reason he said the reason is this, because if these rockets start raining down on Russia, long-range missiles and so on, it will be because Western technicians, Western information, Western guidance systems have made it possible, and that means that, you know, the NATO, the West, the Americans, the British, whoever, would have entered the war directly, and it calls for a response. Okay, but it doesn't seem as far as the public signals are concerned, that the Americans are going to give this permission. And I think there's I have a feeling that there's an underlying political reason, you know, why the Americans, why the Biden administration isn't going to give Zelensky what he wants in this respect. And that's because they are worried about an escalation that might occur as a result of that action. Not necessarily an existential escalation, but an escalation of sorts, which could involve a significant confrontation, direct confrontation between the United States and Russia, which would raise, you know, the specter of nuclear war between the United States and Russia. And any such confrontation, I would think, would completely derail Kamala Harris's attempts to become president of the United States, because it was one of the main linchpins of the Trump campaign is that she's a warmonger, that she's is that this continuing support for Ukraine is dangerous for the United States, is that it's leading in the direction of a third world war. And should there be some kind of like escalation arising out of authorizing Ukraine to use these long range missile attacks, that would hand, I think, my guess would be, that would hand Trump the presidential election on a platter. So I don't think they're going to do that, at least not until the presidential elections are over, unless, of course, you know, we get near the election date and it seems clear that Trump is going to win. Then maybe at that point they might try to engineer something, some kind of international crisis involving Russia arising out of the Ukraine war, which they calculate would help their election chances. But I'm not even sure about that. So I don't think authorization for these rocket attacks is going to be given, and nor do I think there's that. Well, let me just backtrack a bit there. I don't think that's going to happen, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility. Let me make a general point, is that you know, I've consistently been surprised, stunned, in fact, by the recklessness of Western involvement and their proxy war in Ukraine. So I wouldn't put past anything past the West in relation to this war, particularly when you have such a strong kind of hardline lobby in both the United States and Britain are urging escalatory action and making the argument that, well, you know, we escalate before, so we can do it again. Putin will back down. All these threats he's making are not to be taken seriously. So I certainly wouldn't rule out authorization for these long-range missile attacks on the part of Ukraine, but I think it's highly unlikely for the strategic military reasons, and also for this this political reason connected to the American election. The other thing I'd say is that I don't think there's any, there's no possibility, I'm even more certain at this point, there's no possibility that the British are going to authorize the Ukrainians to use their missiles, the Storm Shadow missiles, right? Unless they have the full agreement, explicit agreement, full support of the United States, because any consequences of attacks on Russia, long-range attacks on Russia by Storm Shadow, will have to be dealt with by the United States and not by Britain. So Britain's not going to do anything unless the Americans approve it, unless it's coordinated with the United States. And I, for reasons I've already stated, I don't think the United States is going to do that. Now, in terms of the general picture of where the war is going, yeah, I mean, recently you had Mark Sloboda on interviewed, and yeah, his view was that the war will last for at least another year, until next summer, assuming that Western aid continues to trickle through, And assuming that Ukraine is able to solve its manpower problem, and Mark thinks that the next step on the manpower front might be for the Ukrainians to start conscripting their 18 to 25-year-old demographic. Yeah. Now, Mark may well be right about that. And you know, one thing I will say, again, it's another thing that's consistently surprised me about this war, the way it's panned out, is Ukraine's military resilience, the resilience of the Ukrainian armed forces to be able to absorb huge losses, huge damage, and yet still be able to fight on. Albeit only being able to fight on with Western support, because there's no doubt whatsoever, if the West was to withdraw its military aid to Ukraine or to significantly reduce it, then the Ukrainian armed forces would collapse quite quickly. Okay, so Mark, I think Mark might be right about another year of the war, but I also think it's possible that the end could come sooner than that. Depends on how the Ukrainians handle their battlefield defeats, how they handle their retreats, to what extent they can minimize the damage they're going to suffer as Russian forces are pushing them back across the front. So I think maybe another year, but maybe in the next less than that, in the next few months, we'll get to a position whereby Ukraine would have suffered such military blows that it will feel compelled to to sue for peace, to actually engage in to work towards a ceasefire. And some kind of peace settlement with the Russians. But okay, we'll see what happens. I really can't. I would be amazed if the war is still going on in two years' time. I really don't think the Ukrainians are going to be able to sustain their war effort for another 2 years. I really don't think actually we're going to be able to avoid a significant escalation if the war goes on for another 2 years, because all the time the war is ongoing, there's the very grave danger of some kind of escalation, which could lead to an all-out war between NATO and Russia. Now, at the moment, I think that chance of such an escalation is quite small, but nevertheless, it does exist.
The question is, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, what would be the benefit of Ukraine if the war continues as we saw it during this more than 2 years? And two parties in this conflict, on the Western part, would be the government in Ukraine and the NATO countries. When you look at the conflict, the way that Ukraine is losing on the battlefield, and they're losing more land, compare it with 6 months ago, and there is no future for this conflict when it comes to the Ukrainian part and what they would gain through this conflict. And we know that they're losing on the battlefield, they're losing a lot of soldiers. And at the end of the day, you don't see, when you look at the rhetoric in the Western media, they're talking about, let's fight this conflict, let's kill more Russians. We can understand this type of mindset on the part of Lindsey Graham and these people who are willing to continue this conflict. But when it comes to the Ukrainian government, they're losing their people, they're losing their land. This is so important, this is so crucial. Do you think that the Zelensky administration is totally disconnected with the reality of what's going on in Ukraine and the future of Ukraine?
Well, judge from many objective sort of standpoint, any third party standpoint, if you like, continuing the war makes no sense because what's going to happen is that Ukraine is going to lose more people. It's going to suffer great destruction. It's going to become less and less independent and less sovereign. The longer the war continues, the greater is the chance that that Ukraine is going to, in effect, cease to exist as an independent sovereign state. So, in a way, the Ukrainians are right when they say that this war is existential for them, but it's not stopping the war that's existential for them. It's continuing the war. But look, you can, but that's okay. That's just, if you like, an objective or an attempt at an objective point of view. But you could view the war from a different perspective. Yeah. If you believe that there is still a possibility of turning the war around in some way, or making gains against Russia, perhaps by escalating the degree of NATO involvement in the war, direct NATO involvement in the war, then there's a certain sense to that perspective, and that kind of I would see it as being an illusion or a fantasy. Of course, was reinforced by the recent success of the kind, but by Ukraine in its Kursk incursion. So the other thing, of course, is that the longer the war goes on, the longer the Zelensky regime exists, will continue in power in Ukraine. So from that point of view, it's a rational thing to do. Of course, the price for Zelensky remaining in power is paid by the Ukrainian people. From a Western hardliner point of view, of course, in a way, the actual outcome of the war, whether Ukraine loses or wins or is a stalemate, doesn't matter. The main thing is to actually weaken Russia. So, even fighting a losing war that's enormously costly as far as Ukraine is concerned may be deemed desirable from a Western hardline point of view, who genuinely believe in the Russian threat to Western civilization and see a future direct conflict with Russia coming down the road. So obviously, from that point of view, them fighting the war now makes a certain sense. Now, I have to say, I think, and there's one final angle is that also, if you're a certain kind of Ukrainian nationalist, the important thing is Ukrainian national identity, the myth of Ukraine as a nation, and going down to defeat, even a catastrophic defeat, can become part of that myth of Ukrainian nationalism, of Ukraine battling on to the end. So even a catastrophic defeat can be construed from a kind of an extremist Ukrainian nationalist point of view as actually being beneficial for the long-term historical continuation of European nationhood.
And one of the things that is so strange in order to understand the behavior of the United Kingdom is the new government. That, how do you find it right now in the United Kingdom? We thought that the Labour Party would make some changes, but the way that they're implementing their policy in the United Kingdom, do you find that they're getting more aggressive to the conflict? It seems to me that during this conflict, when this conflict started, we had Poland on the front line. And right now, it's Poland just disappearing. It's just the United Kingdom driving this type of ideological views toward Russia in the European Union. Why is that, in your opinion?
What's happening in relation to Britain is not so surprising. When you consider that when Labour was, there is this very strong pro-Ukraine, anti-Russia consensus in Britain, at least at the political elite level. I don't believe that that view is shared by the British population as a whole, British people, some of them obviously, but I think the majority of British people would be in favour of a more moderate policy in relation to supporting Ukraine and in relation to Russia, would be in favour of bringing the war to an end as soon as possible, some kind of peace, even a compromise peace, and also in favour of repairing relations with Russia. So this anti-Russia elite consensus, I don't think fully reflects the popular view, but nevertheless it exists, and obviously it's in power. And the Labour Party, when it was in opposition, was fully supportive of that consensus. Yeah, there's no, I don't recall any significant dissent by Labour when it's in opposition to the British government's policy in relation to Ukraine, which as you say, has actually throughout the conflict been a very militant anti-Russia policy, been a policy in favour of escalation at every stage, and also a policy of getting involved in what's going on in the war directly, in form of, you know, espionage, sabotage, and that kind of thing. So Labour in government is just continuing the policy it had when it was in opposition, and presumably, when they come into government, one of the first things, they would have been briefed by their military and intelligence on the war in Ukraine and the situation and what next steps to do. And it does seem to be the case that, you know, Britain has more than its fair share of hardline elements among the military and intelligence community. So their briefings would have reinforced what they believed already when they came into office. They bought into this Russophobic line in advance of becoming government. So I think that would have been factored. And then I suppose finally, yeah, you have this, you know, they're a new government. They want to make an impression as a power on the world stage. Yeah. Something dramatic, show their independence, show their mettle, that kind of thing, that kind of psychology. I'm sure is at work to a certain degree, and hence you get this, you know, the British foreign minister, what's his name, Lammy going to Ukraine with Blinken, Zelensky, and then Keir Starmer takes the whole group to the United States to talk to Biden, apparently about this issue of authorizing long-range missile attacks by Ukraine on Russia, and as we know, the whole thing seems to have gone pear-shaped. The British side seems to have miscalculated the possibility of cajoling the Americans into taking a further escalatory step, and I think that reflects that on the American side. Okay, there's certainly a lot of hardline elements within the Biden administration, particularly it seems in Blinken's State Department, but there also seems to be a lot of like pragmatic military people, more realistic military people, who have a much clearer idea of what's going on in Ukraine, what the likely outcome is going to be, and the dangers that arise out of deeper and deeper American involvement in the war for no reason. So I think the pragmatic lobby is much, much, much stronger in the United States than it is on the British side. And I have to say, it seems to be the case that in Poland, the Polish government seems to be becoming more and more pragmatic in relation to the war. I mean, of course, they're a lot closer to the reality of the war than the British are, and Poland is the country is the country second only to Ukraine that would suffer in the event of some kind of escalation of the war. Yeah, so Poland is actually on the front line of this conflict and the dangers that it holds existentially, whereas Britain is on the sidelines. And maybe the British, of course, have their own nuclear weapons, Trident submarines and so on. And perhaps the British believed that ultimately, or at least some of them anyway, believed that ultimately their nuclear weaponry, their nuclear arsenal will protect it or deter any kind of significant action by Russia against Britain.
I think one of the important events during this conflict was the Kursk incursion. And when you look at this attack on the Ukrainian side, they were talking about they want to get something to negotiate, to have an upper hand to negotiate with Russia. But at the end of the day, what was important in this region, it is a tiny land, but the importance was there is a nuclear power plant in this region that was so important for the Ukrainian army. Don't you think that this concept would hugely change the Russian mindset if anything comes next, any sort of negotiation, because they know how Ukrainians can attack on Russian soil and how dangerous would that be for the future, any sort of agreement in the future? And don't you think that this would even make any sort of deal on the part between Russians and the United States or Ukrainians even much more difficult than before? Because Russia knows Ukrainians are getting to a point that they're getting so desperate that would hugely change their mindset and how radical they can get. And don't you think this Kursk incursion it didn't work for Ukrainians, but how did it work for Russians, for a Russian mindset, in your opinion, for the future of any sort of negotiations?
Well, the Kursk incursion certainly didn't work for Ukraine, and there still remains a lot of doubt as to what the operation was all about, what the Ukrainians realistically expected to achieve by it. Okay, I know there's this talk about capturing the Kursk nuclear power station, but even the Ukrainians must have been aware that would be very difficult to achieve. And you capture the power station, what are you going to do with it? You're going to blow it up? You're going to blow yourselves up? It didn't make sense. I think the Kursk thing is partly about Sursky, the Ukrainian commanding troop, trying to find a way to relive, you know, the glory days of the autumn counteroffensive in Kharkov. In the Kharkov area in 2022, where he oversaw the operation, and Ukrainians won back this huge amount of territory, and it was a big boost to morale and changed the whole perception about where the way the war was going and how long it was going to last, and create the illusion of the possibility of a Ukrainian success in the war. You know, I always say that Ukraine's success in Kharkov area in autumn of 2022 was the worst possible thing that could have happened to Ukraine, because it fed this illusion of a Ukrainian victory in the war. So it's partly about Sursky, but it also obviously is very much about Zelensky, and his political goals. And I think I go back to it, you know, I think the political goal of the Kursk incursion was to try to create something which will lead to something else, which will complicate things, create some kind of dynamic, but which will connect up with the possibility of further Western escalation. Or further direct Western escalation. Well, I think everything that Zelensky does, actually has been doing for the last 3 years, has been connected to that goal of involving NATO directly in the war of Russia, turning the Russo-Ukrainian war into a direct NATO-Russia conflict. So that's the way I see that. Okay, but it didn't work out very well. In fact, it worked out very, 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 very badly. The incursion itself is in the process of failing, and of course, it's had a knock-on effect in terms of Russian advances across the whole of the front line, particularly, of course, in Donbass, but not just there, everywhere else as well. As far as the Russians are concerned, I think it has complicated the possibility of negotiations, because they're not, any precondition of negotiation with Ukraine, any like ceasefire or anything at all, is going to be a precondition will be that Ukraine would have been driven out of the Kursk region entirely, or it would agree to withdraw. So I think it has, enormously complicated those negotiations. I don't think it's closed the door on negotiations. I think ultimately Russia and certainly Putin is open to a ceasefire and a negotiated settlement, but the only possible basis for a ceasefire and negotiated settlement are the terms that Putin set out in June. His June for peace proposal, in which he says that Ukraine has to concede Crimea and the four other provinces that have already been incorporated into Russia, formally incorporated into Russia. It has to withdraw from any of those areas unoccupied by Russia, and it has to agree to neutralization, to give up any hope of becoming a member of NATO and to accept neutral states. And if that package is accepted, just what Putin said in June, and he hasn't said anything different since, although the Kursk has complicated matters somewhat, that still remains on the table. The war can end tomorrow, next week, next month, on the basis of Putin's terms. And the chances are, I think, is that the war will end on something like those terms, but it could be a few months down the road. And of course, all the world, Ukraine is suffering ever more devastation. Now, but the other point to be made here, of course, is that the longer the war goes on, depending on what happens precisely on the battlefield, the more inclined or the more pressured Putin might be to up his demands. Yes, to be less willing to make any concessions outside of his central package of demands. Because I think there is a lot of scope for Ukraine in peace negotiations with Russia to gain some things in return, like, for example, Russian to withdraw from territories that occupies that are not part of the four oblasts that have already been incorporated. But the longer the war goes on, the longer the military developments take their own course, the more likely it is that Ukraine is going to be required to pay a higher and higher price in the form of any peace settlement. but the other point I'd like to make here is that you often, you get this argument that Russia is winning, Ukraine's fate is sealed militarily. It's just a question of how long it's going to take. So why would Putin and Russia be prepared to call a halt to the ceasefire, to the war, and negotiate a settlement with Ukraine before it's got to the point where it can be completely confident that any ceasefire and peace settlement will hold and will serve Russia's interests. And what people argue, what Russian hardliners argue, the only way you can really guarantee that is by Russia, you know, occupying in effect the whole of Ukraine and installing or supporting some kind of puppet government or some kind of regime change government that it thinks it can work with. The argument is that it possibly Putin and, you know, the more moderate section of the Russian elite might be heading in that direction as well, and that's certainly a possibility. But look, there are very, very strong reasons for Putin to negotiate a peace settlement with Ukraine, if he can get one, if he can get one on his own terms, if he can get one that satisfies Russia's security requirements, and also a settlement that protects the interests of any, you know, Russian speakers or pro-Russia elements that remain living within the boundaries of post-war Ukraine. And I just highlight two of those here for the sake of discussion. The first thing is that, Russia is winning the war, but it's not without cost. It's at huge cost. We just had published the latest figures by the BBC Media Zone count of Russian military fatalities. And I think this is quite a good count, an accurate count. By their count, it's 70,000. Russian dead soldiers so far in the war, and they also extrapolate another 50,000 dead, which is captured by their, which is not captured by their 70,000 figure, and they might be right. Yeah, maybe 120,000 in total is a bit too high, but maybe it's a bit too low. But I think it's a ballpark figure. Okay, and even for a big country like Russia, those are huge figures. And if you're talking about continuing the war indefinitely in order to cross the Dnieper and capture Kiev, go on to Lvov, occupy the whole of Western Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, you're talking about huge losses. Yeah, maybe doubling or even tripling that kind of number. You're talking about further mobilization. Yeah. So Russia and Putin can fight on, should they choose to do so, and they will fight on. But the costs are huge, and it suits Russia's interests to curtail this war as soon as possible on the basis of a settlement that suits its security interests. And the second reason I think Putin will be inclined to negotiate peace if he can, if it's a possibility. And what will make it a possibility is not what's going on the Russian side, it's what's going on the Ukrainian and Western side. You know, the fundamental block to peace lies with the Ukrainians and with the West, Western hardliners in particular. It's not on the Russian side. But the second reason, general reason, he might be inclined to do so is because this is what Russia's partners and allies in the global South want him to do. That's their position. And and if there's any sniff of a significant and significant, meaningful move on the Ukrainian and Western side towards a ceasefire and some kind of negotiated peace settlement, then I'm sure that Russia's partners in the BRICS, other countries in the global South, particularly China, Brazil, South Africa, will be lobbying Putin to take the necessary risks to actually end the war and to negotiate a peace settlement. And I think that Putin will respond to that pressure, to that lobbying, right? And the reason to do so, it'd be partly because of Russia's dependence on these relationships it's formed with the global South countries, particularly China, of course. But I also think that it will be because Putin has got a much larger project in mind, right? What Putin wants to do is to redesign, remodel global society, global international relations, world politics, right? He wants to end Western global hegemony and establish a much more equal, multilateral system of international relations, based on the principles of sovereignty, independence, and non-interference of states in their internal affairs. So he has the vision for an alternative global order, an alternative to the Western global order, and he has that vision because he sees that kind of balanced multilateralism as being a desirable thing, but also because he sees it as being a context which will guarantee Russia's security or reinforce Russia's security, and also facilitate the development of Russia as a civilization coexisting alongside other civilizations. So there's more at stake in the Ukraine war than just what happens in the war, what happens in relation to Ukraine, Russia's relations with NATO and with the West, the United States, right? There's the rest of the globe to consider, and I don't think Putin would jeopardize that broader ambition he has by taking a hard line in relation to peace negotiations with Ukraine and the West. I think he will, if he can, if it's possible, right? He was, he is, and I think he will still be prepared to engage with peace negotiations, a peace summit, when the time comes.
And when it comes to the territory of Ukraine and right now what's in the hand of Russians, the eastern part of Ukraine, four oblasts, as you've mentioned, we have two cities that are so important, is Nikolaev and Odessa.
Yeah.
These two cities are two key cities in the mind of Russians, in the mind of Ukrainians. But how do you see the position of these two cities? Do you think that Russia would let them in the hand of Ukrainians, or they would ask for some sort of autonomy for these cities?
There's various possibilities. I think the two important cities are not immediately important cities, not those two. They're Kherson City and Zaporozhye, which is the capital of the Zaporozhye Oblast. Kherson, of course, the capital of Kherson District, and those two cities are already part of the Russian claim. They're not occupied by Russia, but that's what they claim. So the issue in my mind is, in terms of any future peace negotiation, or at least any negotiation in the near term, is whether or not Russia will be prepared to concede those cities to Ukraine in some form, or not, or at least not concede that they won't be a direct part of the Russian Federation. But with Nikolaev and Odessa, I think that Putin anyway will be prepared to forego Russian occupation of those two cities. I think it's also very likely going to be part of the deal that, as well as Russia keeping or gaining the territories it's already occupied or claimed, incorporated, there'll be some kind of demilitarized zone, maybe with elements of internationalization of particular cities or territories within it. There's all kinds of schemes you could come up with, and that might be the solution to Odessa and Nikolaev, that kind of, which they remain under Ukrainian control. Of course, Odessa very, very important as far as Ukraine's independence as a state, because of the outlet to the Black Sea. I think that's a possibility, but again, I think it's a possibility now, still just about, that'd be my guess, my judgment, But that may not be the case forever. You know, the longer the war goes on, the more likely it is that Russia is going to feel compelled to militarily occupy Odessa and Nikolaev, and not just those two cities, but also Kharkov, and perhaps even Kiev itself. Now, you know, to do that would be hugely costly. Maybe, you know, like taking Kharkov, Kiev, Nikolaev, and Odessa could actually be more costly to Russia than the price it's already paid. Yeah. If necessary, Putin will go as far as that, if that's what had to happen. And it's not an inconceivable scenario if Ukraine and the West choose to keep on fighting. Yeah, just hang on in there and fight, you know, to the very end. I mean, if you think about 1945, Germany in 1945, Germany was defeated, it was gone. And yet the Red Army had to capture Berlin and force Hitler to commit suicide in order to bring the war to an end. Otherwise, the Second World War might have gone on for several more months, at least. And by the way, yeah, okay, yeah, the Red Army did capture Berlin in April 1945, but 80,000 Soviet soldiers were killed during that Berlin operation. And you could be talking about the same kind of figures if we're talking about, you know, taking Odessa or these other cities, Kharkov, Kiev, for example. So, you know, it's already all very well to say, yeah, well, you know, Odessa, Nikolaev, Russian cities, blah, 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 you know, eternally part of Russia. But consider the cost to Russia of actually taking them back, you know, making them part of the Russian Federation. But I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope that there could be some kind of settlement in which Russia's, you know, presently quite moderate territorial demands are satisfied, and Ukraine keeps control of cities and territories which are important to it, and important to it as an independent sovereign state. Because the other thing I think is okay, Russia, you know, the war, maybe they can destroy Ukraine as an independent sovereign state, yeah, in effect. But I don't think that's in Russia's interest. What's in Russia's interest is to have, you know, an independent sovereign Ukraine, but one that is friendly towards Russia, that has a relationship with Russia, that isn't being used as a cat's paw by various Western interests. That's what's in Russia's interest, and I do believe that Putin will do everything in his power to actually see that that's the case. Obviously, in the long run, obviously it's going to take, you know, years, decades, maybe even generations for both countries to recover from, you know, the trauma, the hostilities, the emotionality of this present war. But, you know, a recuperation by both sides and a restoration of a positive Russian-Ukrainian relationship is possible. And what I think basically what we need to happen is that to end this war is, you know, I keep saying, well, you know, Russia wants peace, Putin wants peace, if it can get a good peace that suits it. But the problem is on the Western and Ukrainian side. Well, I've given up hope on the West doing anything sensible in relation to the war. Although maybe there's political changes in the West, that, you know, in the West, particularly Europe, that situation might change. Or maybe if there's a Trump presidency, right? But I haven't given up on the Ukrainians coming to their senses, yeah, yeah, and seeing that their future as an independent sovereign state with its own kind of identity, its own history, culture, tradition, and so on, that future lies by having a positive association with Russia.
One of the points that from the Zelensky's victory plan, and Le Monde reported that in this, one of the points is Ukraine getting an invitation to be part of NATO from Joe Biden. And when you look at this and the way that they're thinking to be part of the EU, do you think that they are trying to get an invitation in order to facilitate their position to be part of the EU? And how's that possible? Do you think with the current pace of the conflict, with the current political changes that are happening right now, is that possible for Russia to accept Ukraine being part of NATO or EU?
This is just by reports. We don't actually know what is in his victory plan, but reportedly, he wants the part of Ukraine which is still controlled by Kiev, is not under Russian occupation, to be admitted into NATO and to be secured by a NATO guarantee, and he's also again reportedly, saying that the EU should signal, very rapid Ukrainian admission into the EU. Okay, well, neither of those two things are going to happen. If Ukraine was going to be admitted into NATO in any form, it would have happened by now. It's not going to happen. It could only happen at this stage with Russia's agreement. And okay, at one point I thought there might be a possibility that Russia could accept Ukrainian membership of NATO under certain conditions, under certain guarantees, but I think we're beyond that point. Ukraine's never going to be a part of NATO. That's just not going to happen. Ukraine will either be neutral, or it effectively won't exist at all as an independent state. That's the way I see things. EU is a different question. Putin himself has said he has no objections to Ukraine becoming a member of the EU, but hopes that they could still continue to be good relations between Ukraine and Russia. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. That will take, if Ukraine enters EU at all, it's going to take years. Maybe even decades. So that's not an immediate prospect either. But I think all this kind of stuff that Zelensky about, let's into NATO, let's into the EU, do this, do that. I think it's all kind of propaganda, like bombast. It's not serious. I mean, Zelensky surely can't be serious in thinking any of these demands are going to be fulfilled. It's kind of like putting it all out there, hoping that they can't concede any of that stuff, but maybe they'll concede, or maybe they'll give us some more weapons, maybe they'll give us some more money, and maybe they'll agree to unleash us as far as using their missiles for long range attacks on Russia. And that, as I go back to what I said at the beginning, that's the real goal that Zelensky has in mind here. He wants to escalate Russia, NATO, Western involvement in the war, direct involvement, in the hope that leads to something to something bigger. Because that's the only way that he and Ukraine have got out in this present time. Now, of course, were that to happen, and Zelensky was to get his way, then I think there would be an all-out Russian NATO war, and it's very difficult to see how that conflict could stay below the nuclear threshold. And I hope there are enough sensible people in Western establishments, political, military, intelligence, that grasp that fundamental reality.
And you mentioned if Trump wins during this talk, and the question is, how capable would he be to change the conflict in Ukraine? Recently, J.D. Vance, his pick for the vice president, he said that the Europeans should focus on Ukraine if Trump wins. And because our priority is China, it's not Ukraine, it's not what's going on in the European Union.
Well, J.D. Vance has said some very sensible things about Ukraine, about Russia, and about the war. I mean, before he became the vice presidential, Trump's vice president running mate. But of course, it'll be Trump who will call the shots, and who knows what Trump's going to do. Never forget that it was the Trump administration that authorized supply of offensive weapons to Ukraine in 2018. It was under the Trump administration that the significant military buildup of Ukraine into a kind of a de facto NATO bulwark on Russia's borders. It was on Trump's watch. Now you can argue, well, because he was under the influence of the neocons and the blob and the deep state and that kind of thing, may well be true. And maybe this time around he'll be a more independent actor in relation to the Ukrainian situation. But who knows? It's very, very hard to tell. I think we can be fairly sure we can say that Trump as president won't be good news for Ukraine. It will have to be one way or the other. I think it will have to be, you'd have to say it will be yet another negative as far as Ukraine is concerned, which I think, again, partly explains the urgency of, Zelensky's latest kind of like feverish kind of like propaganda offensive, about a plan for victory or a plan for peace or just that and the other. He's desperately trying to get something through, gain something in advance of the American presidential election in case Trump does win. Because at the very least, American aid to Ukraine, I think, is going to diminish quite significantly. And certainly at a rhetorical level, Trump, as he is now, by the way, of course, will be speaking about peace rather than a war, peace perspective rather than war perspective. But of course, with Trump, you never know what he's actually going to do. Obviously very unreliable, which is why, when Putin, Putin said that, didn't he say he preferred Kamala Harris to win? Was it Putin who said that? I think, everyone thinks it's a joke or it's Putin kind of like winding up the Biden administration or whatever it might be. But actually, I think there might be a certain underlying truth in that, because Kamala Harris administration will be more predictable and perhaps more handleable from the Russian point of view. And I also think the Russians have concluded this long ago that what happens in terms of American domestic politics is secondary in the bigger picture. So they're focused on the war in Ukraine. They're focused on their relations with the global south, with China. I think they've downgraded the importance of the United States and its domestic political disturbances into something that's of secondary importance.
Yeah, as I mentioned, it's not just Donald Trump, and because recently there was an article in Bloomberg talking about whoever wins the 2024 presidential election in the United States, at the end of the day, the United States would leap the European Union, because their priority is China right now. It's not there.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if Kamala Harris wins or Donald Trump. But the question is, I think one of the goals, one of the objectives, it was very important during this conflict on the part of the United States, was to disconnect, to separate the European Union from Russia. That was quite successful when you look at what's going on between Germany and Russia, between the United Kingdom, all these countries together, France with Russia. But if the United States decides to go to make some sort of new policies toward China, do you think the European Union, is there any sort of substantial understanding on their part to understand that if something happens between the United States and China, the Russia being connected or being part of the European security would be so important for the existence of Europe. Do they really understand that?
I don't, the answer is no. At least if we're talking about the current EU or European establishment, yeah? No, they don't. But, I mean, obviously that could change. You know, there are like political changes are in motion in France, in Germany, in other countries. It's all pointing in a direction away from this hardline anti-Russia hawkish consensus within the EU. And of course that political development runs parallel with the wishes of European peoples, public opinion, yeah, which has never been as hawkish as the leadership has been. And I would say, very definitely, is against escalation of involvement in the Ukraine war, wants to see the war end as soon as possible, wants peace, wants negotiations, wants to, find a way to coexist with Russia. But that public opinion, it's finding expression in terms of the kind of parties that people are voting for in different countries, but it's not finding much expression at the top levels of various EU governments and the EU itself. But in terms of EU's relationship with Russia, that relationship is something that the EU has created for itself, has done itself, has damaged itself. I don't think you can blame, the Americans for that. Throughout this whole war, the EU has had choices that it could make, or the EU countries. Okay, they were difficult choices, given the reliance on NATO and given the reliance on American military power for fundamental security. But there were choices that could have been made, that could have taken things in a different direction, at least politically. But no, they chose to jump on the anti-Russia bandwagon. They allowed themselves to be overly influenced by hardcore Russophobes in Europe and also in the United States, but that was their choice. The signs that at least some of them are beginning to regret those choices. I wouldn't rule out. I know recently we had this very like hawkish resolution passed by the European Parliament by an overwhelming majority, which was in favour of allowing Ukrainians to use these long-range missiles against Russia and said nothing whatsoever, this resolution about peace, or diplomacy or negotiations or anything like all kind of things you associate with the EU's identity historically as being a peace project, being in favor of negotiations and finding compromises, finding solutions. No, there's none of that in this resolution. It's just a hard line broadside calling for the war to be escalated and the EU to escalate its involvement and to intensify its anti-Russia stance. So that's the starting point. But I think the direction politically is away from is in the opposite direction. So there might be some beneficial changes in European political dynamics in the future. And I certainly think that will be the case. I mean, once the war ends, once there is some kind of ceasefire, some kind of peace settlement, assuming it's a real settlement, I think alternative trends in European politics in relation to Russia I think will become stronger and stronger, because obviously it's very hard at the moment for people with doubts about this anti-Russia policy or to raise their voices, because you immediately get slapped down as being a Putin apologist or an appeaser and that kind of thing. But once the war's over, you know, the political climate changes, the discourse will shift. But I think in that context, you know, more pragmatic, more sensible political elements will come more and more to the fore in Europe, but also in Britain, I hope, and also in the United States, or at least I hope so.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thanks for the invitation. Hope to see you again soon.
See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.